Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast, brought to you by Athletes on the Rise. Nowadays, athletes need to develop in multiple ways to obtain college scholarships and professional contracts. Athletes on the Rise will do just that. AOTR uses multidisciplinary sports science knowledge to develop complete athletes mentally, physically, technically, and tactically. We go above and beyond what is expected to give athletes a training experience that is tailored to the individual. We constantly push our athletes outside their comfort zones, and we make sure that athletes are doing the right things in the right way to maximize their development. Athletes on the Rise, training redefined. Follow us online, ask us questions, read our content. Our website is http://aotr.training. Find us on Instagram @aotr.training, Twitter @aotr_training, and facebook.com/AOTR.training. Before we get to today's guest, I'm going to give a brief overview of the upcoming guests on this podcast. First, we will have Brandon Linton. Brandon is formerly the assistant coach at West Point, which is a program, a Division I program for Army. There they do a great job developing leadership and a sense of servitude. So we are going to be diving into those details about how they create such great leaders and a great sense of servitude to one another. From there, we will have Isaac Murier, who has been a nutritionist at the University of Georgia and who is currently with Impact Basketball. Over at Impact Basketball, he does a lot of work with NBA athletes and adjusts their diet to get them to perform and recover in the best ways. So we'll be having conversations of, you know, some basic tenets of nutrition, the best ways to recover, and how to go about instilling better nutritional habits. So that is going to be a great informational podcast for parents, players, coaches, etc. From there, we will be getting into a phenomenal conversation with a phenomenal person, Coach Heather Stewart. Coach Stewart has coached with USA Basketball, in addition to doing some work with the Golden State Warriors, and she has also coached at the collegiate and high school levels. Now, Coach Stewart has done a phenomenal job, again, I use that word a lot, turning around programs. She is great at taking a losing culture and pretty quickly turning it around into a championship culture. She's done it time and time again, where she will take teams that barely win, if at all, and within one season, they're sometimes getting up to be championship contenders. So I highly recommend that podcast because we will be talking about the small details of how to get everybody to buy in, how to get athletes to work hard, be resilient, be for one another, get the parents and organization so they buy in as well. And, you know, those processes that are put into place to ensure that the organization and the entire support group will have a successful year. So I highly, highly, highly recommend that you listen to that podcast if that is something that you would like to improve. Today's guest is a phenomenal guest. We have Reiner Meisterjahn, who is a mental performance coach. He owns Cortex Performance, a consulting group for athletes, players, coaches, and organizations who wish to bring their mental game to another level. Cortex is most known for their role in helping NBA teams evaluate draft prospects at NBA pre-draft events. They also work with individual athletes and other professional sport organizations to integrate mental training more proactively, helping them create the identity they want while finding tangible ways to hold each other accountable. We'll address a few specific mental tools, visualization, meditation, and self-talk, and how you can train each one to improve your ability to perform under pressure, become more resilient, and become more confident. Finally, we will speak to the parent-athlete and coach-athlete relationships and how to properly support athletes to ensure they keep their passion for the game. Thank you again to Reiner for sharing this information, to all the Rise Up Podcast listeners who are about to begin. So turn the brains on, be ready to learn. Here we go. Coach Eric here on the Rise Up Podcast, here with my friend, Reiner Meisterjahn from Cortex Performance. He is a mental performance coach. How you doing, Reiner?
Good, man. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you on. You know, I've been looking forward to this for a while. So we're gonna dive right into it. I know you're a busy man, and you're doing a lot of work out there in this mental performance world. So we're gonna jump right in. First question. You know, what is a mental performance coach? What does that profession entail?
Yeah, great question. You know, essentially, I help athletes, coaches, and teams really. Deal with a number of topics ranging from, you know, focus, confidence, to building leadership skills, establishing more effective communication, even looking at motor skills, learning as part of that, looking at, you know, how coaches go about structuring practices to cater to different learning styles in athletes, things of that nature. And then we also do a lot of personality assessment. We're really big on understanding how each individual is wired and how you can best tailor mental skills applications to them. And beyond that, we've also done a lot of work around the NBA pre-draft, where we specifically assess players for fit within different types of cultures.
Okay. So that's obviously a very broad scoping. Those are broad scoping themes. Would you be able to dive into a couple of them? Let's start off with some of the personality assessments, for example. Like how are those type of assessments run? Is that something where you have conversations with them? Are they written? And then what are you hoping to learn from them? And then how, you know, let's start there, and then we'll build off of that a little bit.
Right. So we use assessments from third-party providers where we, you know, in a more systematic way, really try to capture what someone's personality is. So looking at, you know, what is their unique need for structure versus being a more creative individual. And then, you know, beyond that, obviously we look at what does that mean at an applied level, but really understanding how one person is different from the next, you know, what, and looking at what is their basic desire for physical activity? What is their preference in terms of being more independent versus more interdependent in a team sport context? Also looking at what's somebody's desire for, we call it power. So essentially, like how determined and how interested are they in assuming leadership types of roles. So there's a whole bunch of different variables that we look at, and essentially it's a composition of all of those that make for the uniqueness of each individual. And then we, advise organizations on how to best work with the individual if they do draft him in the case of the draft, or okay. With our individual clients, we look at how we can tailor our mental skills training applications to the personality of the athlete.
So really, in from an NBA pre-draft perspective, it's really taking a look at that coach-athlete relationship, you know, how you can, at least that's a part of it, how you can best communicate, how you can best say things to an individual or critique an individual to get the best results. And am I on the right page, or am I going down a different path?
Yeah, no, I think you're on the right page. You know, it's in many ways about fit. I think what most professional sports organizations want to be able to do is to predict performance, but I think that's really difficult to do when you look at personality, when you look at the mental game. It's really hard to predict how somebody is going to be performing in, you know, 2 or 3 years down the road. But what you can do is you can look at, well, how does this individual fit within the culture? How does he fit with the resources that an organization can provide? So you can ultimately essentially put the athlete in a favorable position to where they can help you to the best of their ability. So that's how we really look at it. It's about understanding the personality, as opposed to necessarily trying to strictly predict long-term performance.
Right. So compare and contrast, you know, without naming names, obviously, you know, different types of personalities and organizations. You know, you have X personality that is like this, and that's going to fit really well with, you know, Z organization. Would you be able to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you look at organizations that are much more structured in their approach, you obviously want to get players in there that are more systematic in their thinking, that players that appreciate a, routine-oriented type of day. Players that appreciate and feel comfortable in a structured offense that entails a lot more play calls. You know, whereas certain types of personalities that are maybe more focused on like being creative, like kind of going with the flow, those might do well. Might do better in the organization where on the court it's much more free flowing. It's a little bit more, you know, when you compare sort of the like a streetball type of system, if you will, to take it to an extreme, to something that's much more systematic. Like when you think about the really great San Antonio Spurs teams and the Tim Duncan era and stuff like that.
Yeah, because there's obviously been a lot of talk in the drafts where you might get this player that is a really really good player, but then when they go into the system, you can just tell they're not that right fit. And then once their contract adds up and they go to another team, all of a sudden they're blossoming because now they're in that environment that they feel more connected to and they feel more at ease with.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had a chance to spend time around a couple of different organizations, and one of them was the Miami Heat, for instance. And it's no secret that the Miami Heat are very much about getting players in there that are wanting to put in reps on the court, right? Like guys that actually want to practice in the NBA, right? Because there are a lot of teams that don't really practice a whole lot. But, that's why Jimmy Butler has been a really good fit down there, because he wants to get in the gym. You know, he wants to work hard. You know, Miami also is more willing to maybe take on players that are a little bit rougher around the edges, because that's just the types of personalities that they feel a little bit more comfortable with and feel like they can sort of harness and utilize, as opposed to other organizations that are maybe like, quote unquote, a little bit more clean cut.
Right. And I mean, even going just looking at the draft they had this past year with Tyler Arrow, I mean, he's one of those kids that you have to lock out of the gym. You know, I was speaking with Eric Stang the other day, who knows what Dunlop, I forgot his name. Drew Dunlop, and just talked about, if Miami ever wants to keep him out of a gym, they're literally going to have to lock up every single gym down there. But that's, that's the type of player that they're looking for, because that's what they feel they need in order to be successful.
Exactly. Right.
All right, so let's speak a little bit to this. So you've worked with a variety of levels and a variety of players at different levels. Are there any things that you see from like a mentality standpoint that is different between, say, someone that's a reserve or that's a starter, or someone that gets a lot of minutes versus not a lot of minutes, all star, superstar, et cetera? Are there any things that like stick out from a mentality perspective?
That's such a great question. To me, it's always more so a matter of looking at, well, what is the guy's, potential ceiling, if you will, if there is one, but really looking at potential and understanding how much of their potential is the guy utilizing, right? And it doesn't matter necessarily what particular role they're in. Like I remember Matthew Dellavedova when he was with the Bucks, he was one of those guys that did everything. In terms of really maximizing his more limited potential relative to, LeBron James or someone like that. Right. And, Dele was somebody that was always a role player, but that was able to make a tremendous impact on his team. So to me, it's not so much a matter of, how many minutes does a guy play, like how, do they become an all-star or not. It's more so about maximizing opportunities, and that's where you get all types of different personalities. I mean, obviously, someone like LeBron, he's done a tremendous job maximizing, his gifts, which are obviously a lot more than what most guys have in terms of natural talent. But,
So do you feel like there are certain personalities that actually fit certain roles better on the team?
I think so. I mean, obviously, when you look at, say, like the point guard position, I know you had Skylar on the other day. The reason Skylar is a tremendous point guard is for a number of reasons, really. But when you look at it strictly from a personality standpoint, he's somebody that's very interactive. outgoing type, somebody that understands how to communicate, somebody that understands how to connect with different types of people. And I think that's a tremendous skill that that you really need at the point guard position to be as good as you can be. You know, now your ability to communicate and connect with different guys in that way might be slightly less important at a different position, you know, but certainly at the right. point guard position, you got to be able to bring that to the table.
So let's say you have a point guard that is on the opposite end of the spectrum. Let's say they aren't very interactive. They don't know how to communicate very well. They're a little bit more introverted. What is it that you can do, or is there something that you can do to better develop those leadership roles within their personality and to, you know, help them be successful? Like, you know, is it the end of the road for that player, or what can you do to help them improve so they can be, you know, play to their potential?
Yeah, I definitely think there's a lot of things you can do. You know, and obviously in me mentioning Skyler's example, it doesn't mean that you can't have a great point guard who is a little bit quieter and maybe leads mm-hmm. in different ways. But let's say you do have somebody that's more introverted like that and not particularly verbal. Mm-hmm. In that case, I would want to understand what's keeping them from communicating. Is it that they're shy to do so? Is it that they don't see a need to communicate? You know, sometimes it's a matter of educating them about what their teammates most need from them, right? And really helping facilitate those types of conversations, mm-hmm. right? And then it's also a matter of proactively teaching communication skills and setting tangible goals of like, hey, next game, how about like five times per half, you make it a point to like go over to a teammate individually and verbally build them up in some kind of way. So setting tangible benchmarks and trying to make the mental game more concrete and specific, much like we do with the box score, you know, because we obviously know, like, when you score like 15 plus points in a game, that's pretty good. You know, you pull down double digit mm-hmm. rebounds, that's pretty good. But with the mental stuff, sometimes we just, and the leadership stuff, we just need to make it more tangible and set goals for guys to strive towards.
Mm-hmm. So I know, you know, we had some previous conversations about this as well as some of the work you do with Wurzburg. And that seems to be, you know, some of the things that you've done. And I know we spoke about it a little bit with Skyler, but can you talk about how you were kind of introduced to that team, your role there, and how you've developed these different qualities that have helped them be successful at what they do?
Right. So it was the head coach who brought me in. I'd worked with Dennis previously in Cologne a couple of years ago in the Pro A, the second division in Germany, and then eventually landed in Wurzburg and brought me out there last year and initially had me just work with a couple of guys on the roster, primarily remotely. I made one trip out there, and then this season we made it a point to integrate mental training a little bit more proactively, so I was able to take a couple of trips out there. I might have taken another one if it weren't for this damn coronavirus. So it's been a mix of different things in terms of my responsibilities. We've done a lot of stuff at the team level in terms of just trying to establish a value system for the guys and attaching tangible actions to our core values for the team to bring to life each and every practice and game as best as possible. And then I've also worked with a number of guys individually, in some cases teaching mental skills to maybe help deal with pressure or help, grow into more effective leadership roles, for instance. And then I've also helped facilitate a lot of communications between teammates or between coaches and players and things of that nature.
Okay. So when you're saying like attaching tangible actions to core values, that goes a little bit to, you were five times a half, you can verbally and visually, you know, give some help to a teammate as an example. What are other examples of how you are creating more tangible actions to core values, and how do you even develop those core values to start?
Well, initially I had the guys sit down really in a players only meeting plus myself and just brainstorm on different things that they felt like they wanted to stand for as a group. And then we eventually narrowed it down to five things. And, you know, that, then we looked at tangible actions to attach to each of those. You mentioned the example of, let's just say, like, you know, with the verb, like, how many times per game do you engage verbally? You know, mm-hmm. that might be an example of something. I know one of our core values was toughness. So even looking at what does that mean statistically? So the players did some good brainstorming there, as did the coaches. So just trying to attach tangible statistical benchmarks mm-hmm. to that, but then also looking at specific behaviors on the court, you know, like diving after loose balls and things of that nature. You know, so again, right. like trying to make it as concrete as possible so we understand if we're living up to what we say we want to stand for, and it doesn't just become something that's like sort of fluffy but not particularly meaningful.
Right. So basically create that structure. You know, this is who we are, this is our identity, this is what we stand for, but it's not just talking it out, you can actually visually see it. You know, this, you know, we can say it, we can tell we're tough. We're a tougher team because we're doing X, Y, and Z. We can tell that we are, you know, great communicators because of, you know, A, B, and C, et cetera. And you can go back and then, you know, hold yourselves accountable, it sounds like, to be able to make sure people are going in the direction that they need to, both individually and as a team.
Exactly. I mean, it's like, you know, look, if you're looking to be one of the toughest teams in the league and you come in bottom five in rebounding, I think that's a pretty good indicator mm-hmm. that you're not living up to your core value in that case, right? Right. So again, it's about making the mental game, you know, just tangible and measurable to a degree.
Right. So let's go back to, we'll kind of weave a couple of these things together between the NBA pre-def draft stuff that you do in addition to the stuff over at Wurzburg and with other teams. You know, you talk about the personality assessments and do you mean like you'll get into like Clifton Strengths Finder, you get into these different, structured approaches, assessments, mm-hmm. How does that, you know, and there's obviously research based to it and everything else, but what are you able to draw from those assessments to be like, okay, this is overall, you know, this is how we operate. Because obviously not everybody is in one cup or the other. It's a spectrum of things. But how do those assessments give you the information that you need, and what do they give you that you need in order to base some preliminary understandings of how people work?
Right. So I just kind of take you through what it looks like at the team facility with a given NBA team at the time of the pre-draft. So essentially, guys would typically come in groups of six to work out in front of team executives and coaches and whatnot. So they come in the morning. At that point, we sit them down and have them take a computer-based personality assessment. In the past, we've used the Reese Motivation Profile, which essentially breaks down 16 different scales that describe people's motives, which sort of lead to personality traits and help explain behavior. So in any case, so, you know, they come in, take that assessment, which takes about 15, 20 minutes to knock out. Then after that, they'll eventually get on the court after they do all their medical stuff, go through the workout. I'll go watch it, take some notes on body language and things mm-hmm. like that. And then in the afternoon, I'll, at least with the top prospects, I'll sit down for one-on-one interviews. All the guys also will interview with the front office. But, you know, I like sitting down one-on-one with guys to, one, ask some questions to help validate and confirm what came out of the personality assessment. And then secondly, more broadly speaking, I want to understand, hey, like, how do you even see your mental strength? How do you see your challenges and areas you got to work on? And then what strategies do you currently have in place to address your mental game? So it's really an exercise in self-awareness for these guys. And I want to understand how thoughtful and prepared these guys are when it comes to the mental side of the game. And then eventually we tie all that information together. In some cases, we might also have access to scouting reports that the organization has put together that speak to personality a little bit. We pull all that information together and put it into a report and then eventually make recommendations to the front office.
Okay. So do you, as you're going through and you ask them, you know, what do you see your mental strengths and weaknesses? Do you feel like you get pretty straight on answers, or do people sometimes try to, what's the word I'm looking for, kind of pull the wool over your eyes, so to speak?
I feel like we get quite honest answers, to be honest with you, because you got to set it up in the right way and help players understand that that while you're there to evaluate them, you're also there to help them look good in terms of really communicating to the organization who they are and how the organization will best be able to support them if they do get drafted there. So it's really a matter of empowering these guys and also getting them to understand that, hey, just because you struggle in a particular area of your mental game, we don't perceive that as a weakness. We just look at it as something that we can help you address to become your best self. Yeah, because right now you're sitting here for a reason. Like, you wouldn't be sitting here if we didn't already like you, right? And we don't expect you to be perfect either.
Right. So you talked to them about, you know, upfront, you know, what strategies do you have in place to help your mental game, so to speak? What kind of answers do you find with that? Do you find at that level, that at that stage, a lot of them already have some mental tools that they work with, or for a lot of them, is it pretty new?
It's a bit of a mix. For most guys, it's probably not as well developed as I'd like to see it, but you know, there are certainly guys that come through that have previously worked with a mental coach and have visualization scripts in place and have addressed their self talk and different things of that nature. And then there are other guys that speak to their mental game a little bit more broadly and maybe don't even quite understand what allows them to be successful, right? And mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's definitely a bit of a mix. At times, we might also have guys come through that really have a tremendous mental game and have a tremendous mental skill set, but they're just not able to vocalize it as well as others, right? And that's something that we got to try to understand to the best of our ability as well.
Right. So it might be a little bit more of an innate mental game where they know how to reset and know how to refocus and know how to stay competitive, but they don't actually recognize that they're doing it. You know, it's pretty autonomic at that stage.
Right.
So you're saying, you know, it's a real mixed bag, and you know, you'd like to see it at a higher level before they get to that stage. You know, what are some things that can happen at the high school and even middle school levels to start to just, you know, have a little bit of focus on that mental game? That's so important. And once you get to that higher level, you know, that a lot of times that's what separates the best from the very best.
Right. So I'm a big proponent of mindfulness, and mindfulness means a lot of different things, or it can look a lot of different ways anyways. Really, I want to help on the front end. I always want to help athletes become more aware and more mindful of who they are, you know, who they are in relation to their environment, you know, what they're good at, what they struggle with, what their personality is, and how it might help explain some of their positive as well as some of their problematic behaviors. I want them to be mindful of why they play their sport. So it's really a matter of building awareness and then slowly teaching these young athletes how to be purposeful about taking action, so that everything you do for a reason that you're aware of. If that makes sense. And then from there, we slowly start building out a more concrete set of mental skills, such as, like, I look at four different areas. I like teaching guys some general day-to-day mental and life skills. That could be something like, daily morning meditation for 10 minutes just to find some balance, right? And then we look at pre-game or pre-performance skills. That's where I oftentimes look at a specific visualization routine that I might teach them. We look at in-game mental skills, such as, you know, focus cues and behaviors, different ways to trigger behavior that you want to go to, different ways of managing and navigating your own internal self-talk. during the game, different ways of proactively engaging with teammates. And then we look at post-game mental skills as well. So systematic ways of breaking down your performance, whether you played poorly or you played great, but really, you know, developing the ability to analyze what just happened and then being able to make appropriate adjustments going into the next game.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I think that is super important with, all those things, life skills, pregame, in-game, postgame. I mean, that's, and even along those lines, you know, from what I've read and researched and talked about with other people, a lot of those things, you know, that's all also trainable in practice. You know, those are times where if coaches are purposeful with it, or a sports performance coach like yourself is purposeful with it and bringing it in, you know, that's where you get those mental skills integrated. That's where people can learn before practice, you know, how can you get yourself, you know, more likely to be in the zone and to be really focused in? How do you recover from mistakes during, you know, competitive situations and keep things where they need to be, where you're at your optimal, you know, level. And in addition to, you know, obviously that post game or post practice, yeah, what did I do well? Why do I think I did well with it? Did I hit my targets and, you know, what I have to do going forward? I definitely agree. I mean, and even small things. I was talking with another person yesterday, Joy Burke, who plays for the Chinese Taipei national team, and she, you know, she's played in Europe and Division I at ASU. She was speaking about how even at her, you know, when she first started working with her first skills trainer, first thing she was one of those very perfectionistic type of athletes. And she was talking about, yeah, whenever I'd miss a shot, you know, the first thing he taught me how to do is just how to clear my mind, you know, just using the word clear, you know, you miss clear where you don't, you know, you don't carry on that negative motion between one and the other. Okay, so let's jump into a little bit into those in-game situations. You know, you have some of those players that are quote unquote notorious for choking. Okay, those athletes that just when it comes up in a big moment or close to a big moment, they can't seem to handle the pressure. Why does that happen, and what can those type of athletes do about that?
So it's to me, it's about managing your focus, right? Oftentimes when we struggle to perform under pressure, it's because we're not present minded. We're too focused on the outcome that we're anticipating or fearing, or we're too focused on something that's already happened. Like, you know, maybe you missed your previous five shots and now you're still kind of stuck in, thinking about that. So really it's helping the athlete manage their focus. Sometimes that you can do that by just helping them figure out where to visually focus. Oftentimes you'll see that athletes that are struggling with pressure maybe look off into the crowd a lot more, or are just not as focused on the rim when they're shooting free throws in the clutch, things of that nature. I think it's also important to help athletes understand that, hey, just because you feel anxious, that's not necessarily a bad thing, right? It's oftentimes feeling anxious about feeling anxious that then leads to quote unquote choking under pressure. But that first layer of anxiety is something that I think a lot of athletes experience, and a lot of great athletes have acknowledged experiencing. So just really keeping that anxiety in perspective and understanding how to, how to sort of navigate it by, for instance, regulating your breath, right, to kind of calm down your heartbeat a little bit, or by using your time differently. For instance, during a dead ball, right, like engaging more with teammates to get outside of your own head when you're overthinking things. So those are just some examples.
Sure. So for those that might not have a complete understanding, what are signs of like, hey, I'm pretty anxious in this moment? Like, what happens physiologically and mentally in those moments?
Definitely for a lot of guys, it's increased heartbeat. Maybe your extremities, your hands or your feet get cold, or they get sweaty. Things like that. And then obviously it's a main problem for a lot of athletes is just an overactive brain. So if you're by nature somebody that has a high level of curiosity, or if you're by nature somebody that that seeks acceptance and approval from other people, it's very likely that that your brain is going to be in overdrive in those moments, unless you know how to regulate it.
Right. So it's just thinking about all the different things instead of just onto one thing where it's perfectly clear and things are just kind of happening slow in slow motion. And so, like, so you have that end of the spectrum, that anxiety spectrum, that pressure, that choking spectrum. But then you have the other end of the spectrum where, you know, athletes speak of this feeling of just being in the flow where everything just kind of slows down and time kind of slows down. Are those the same tools that you would use to overcome anxiety to get into kind of those flow states, or is there something like another level athletes have to go to be able to accomplish that?
Well, for one, I should say why flow state is something that obviously is nice to be in, and a lot of us have experienced mm-hmm. at different times. It's not something I really spend a whole lot of time talking about, because to me, it's a state that happens so infrequently that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense making it your goal as an athlete to get into that flow state. But with that being said, certainly by practicing different mental skills such as meditation or having your pregame visualization or managing your in-game self-talk, shifting your focus to relevant cues, things of that nature, it helps put you in a position to where the chances of you getting into a flow state are a lot higher. So I look at it that, but to me, the main thing always is that athletes really need to learn how to win ugly. Like, to me, that's more important than always striving mm-hmm. for a flow state, because especially in team sports like basketball, there's so many confounding variables, so many things that can happen, so many factors that are unpredictable, that it's really tough to consistently be in like a great rhythm, you know?
Sure. So for the listeners out there, can you briefly just differentiate between, you know, some of the tools you talked about as far as meditation, visualization, and self-talk?
Yeah. So let's start with meditation. Okay. So meditation, mm-hmm. you can meditate in a whole lot of different ways. I think the biggest misconception that athletes in my experience have about meditation is that meditation is about a sustained focus. So it's about completely quieting your mind and like sitting down and just being in this ridiculous Zen state for like an hour straight. But
right.
But,
that's not always what it is.
No, it's definitely not, you know, and I've talked to meditation teachers that have been practicing for like 25 plus years and they still struggle really keeping their focus on their breath for more than like 2-3 breaths at a time. So meditation really is more so a tool to build awareness and to become mindful of emotions that are coming through you, thoughts, external things that you become aware of, and then learning to notice and then let go and then refocus again. So really, you might have heard about neuroplasticity. So mm-hmm. our brain's ability to sort of rebuild yep. itself, like form new like neural connections and stuff like that. That really in meditation happens by refocusing over and over again, more so than it's a matter of, a sustained focus over long periods of time, right? So mm-hmm. meditation is just one simple tool to build mindfulness. And in turn, just very basically put, it's a matter of like sitting down or laying down, ideally sitting down and just making, really like focusing on your breath, right? Your in-breath, your out-breath, and keeping your focus right there as best as possible. And so, mm-hmm. Gently returning it to your breath whenever your mind starts drifting without judging yourself for it.
That's very reminiscent of what, Phil Jackson would talk about all the time, getting into a Zen-like state, so to speak. But you'd hear athletes all the time, Michael and Kobe and so on and so forth about how they were, just kind of being in the moment, relishing the moment. And that's, you hear that in interviews and a lot, and that's instantly what my mind goes to is like, hey, that's a super important mental skill, like just being in the moment and being here doing what I need to do. And I think, yeah, like you said, that's a real, if you're able to do that, you'll be much more successful at the task in hand rather than having that mind scattered all over the place, so to speak. Exactly. But no, I like the way you kind of describe those different ways of getting into it. So like if your end game is mindfulness meditation, is that something that is most commonly practiced outside of the of competition, or is it something that you can also use during your breaks, during the game? Like how is that used?
I suppose you can use a many form of meditation, even in game, right? Mm-hmm. Typically, I'll have my athletes practice meditation, say in the mornings after they get up, or potentially pregame. But then in game, sometimes it's just a matter of pausing during a dead ball or a timeout or something, and just taking a couple of conscious breaths. So it's a mini meditation of sorts. And the more formal meditation practice that we're talking about, it's just one tool to build mindfulness, right? It's just one of many tools, really. And it doesn't always resonate with every athlete, but certainly a lot of people like it once they understand it well enough.
Right. Okay, so that's the one tool. The other one we've talked a lot about is visualization. Let's have you describe what that is and how it's used.
Yeah, visualization is just really a practice to imagine yourself potentially in situations that you're looking to master, or it could be simply, thinking about situations you've already been in, recalling some of your highlights, essentially creating these visual images so as to best put yourself in a position to where you're going to be ready to play when you're in a real game. So with my athletes, I typically have them go through a 10-minute pregame visualization where I kind of split it up into different segments. So I'll have them spend the first 3 minutes, give or take, just recalling their highlights, essentially as a boost of confidence, thinking back to the best moments they've been in, going over, like seeing themselves executing their best skills, things like that. Then for the second segment, which is also about 3 minutes, give or take, I have them practice visually responses to adversity. So seeing themselves in situations that are potentially going to happen, such as turning the ball over or missing a few shots or getting in foul trouble.
Yeah. And mistake then, recovery. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then proactively, preparing positive responses to that. Right. Mm-hmm. And then the third segment really is more game specific. That's where you visually go over your matchups, like a lot of guys already do anyways. So going over your matchups, going over different plays that your team might run in that particular game. And then eventually you follow all that up with just a minute of deep breathing. So essentially doing a mini meditation at the back end of that before you then go into your physical warm-up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the final one you spoke a lot of is self-talk. Again, describe what that is and then how that be used.
Yeah, so all of us have some sort of internal dialogue, and we produce a ridiculous number of thoughts per day, and oftentimes those thoughts are not particularly helpful to us, right? So it could be an athlete that goes into a game and she starts off missing a few shots and then starts telling herself, man, like, I suck, I'm a terrible shooter, whatever, and you kind of start going down that path, right? Yeah. Where it impacts your confidence, and then maybe the game is over before the time the clock is up, right? At least for you as an individual athlete. So in that case, I really try to help athletes identify thoughts that are going through their mind, and then potentially reframing some of those thoughts and picking more productive and positive thoughts. In other cases, athletes that have these sort of automated negative instances of self-talk from just like years of practice, quote unquote. Right?
Yeah. Right.
I mean, we all do it, but some people really do it to the extreme. In that case, I sometimes try to just simply help the athlete understand that, hey, just because your brain is producing these negative thoughts and you're having trouble changing them to something positive, doesn't mean that you have to listen to your brain. You can just sort of allow those negative thoughts to hang around while still choosing positive actions and responses. Mm-hmm. And the more you do that, the more your self-talk is eventually going to follow your actions. So there's a couple of different ways of getting at it, I suppose.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you don't necessarily, ever, you know, try not to think about it because it's like the pink elephant in the room. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Then you're going to end up thinking about it. So you just kind of have to let that, let those negative thoughts, I guess, come into mind. And then from there, just, you know, choose to make a positive action, so to speak. So how do you go about, we spoke to neuroplasticity earlier. How do you take that neural chunk, so to speak, and get it replaced? Like what does that process look like? Are there different techniques outside of just, you know, the sheer repetition of positive action afterwards? How has that improved over time?
I think that's really what it is, right? It's pretty simple. Like it's a matter of consistently choosing to engage positively with a negative thought, right? And the more you do that, that neural connection, the negative one is gonna weaken, and you're gonna strengthen the new positive one. But it just takes a lot of reps to make that happen. You can, you know, get at it in different ways through different actions, through reframing, through mind body practices too. You know, sometimes the best way to deal with negative thinking and with anxiety and pressure and things like that is to really focus on your body instead of focusing overly on your mind. Like I know for me as an athlete and just as a person in general, like I'm a very curious individual. So at my worst, I definitely tend to overthink. So I remember my meditation teacher telling me one time, "Hey, Reiner, like, stop trying to think your way out of it, right? Like, like go to body practices." Yeah. It could be, you know, energy type of practices. A lot of folks like energy point tapping, for instance, which I've gotten into a little bit. I'm no expert at it, but that's just an example. For other guys, it's just simply going through a stretching routine. Or just, if you're overthinking at home, just get out on a walk or a run or something like that.
Right. Just something to air out the mind, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So let's segue a little bit into some other dynamics. So we kind of spoke about how you work with different organizations, you work with different individuals and the tools you bring to them and the situations you help them overcome. But let's talk a little bit again. If you're knowledgeable in this area, you know, I'm learning more and more as we go along about the things you work with. But let's speak a little bit to that parent athlete situation. You know, when we're looking at in middle school and high school, what do you see if you see anything between the parent athlete relationship that is. Potentially positive? What do you see in positive situations that allow the kids to grow and continue to have enjoyment and be at their best? And what situations do you see where, you know, you might have that overbearing parent? You know, what are things that you see that parents do that would, you know, basically not be effective in helping kids be their best?
Man, that's a loaded question. Talk about all day long, you know.
Right.
The one thing that I found, Eric, is that most parents that I've dealt with, they have the right intentions, but very few like truly understand how to connect with their kids effectively when it comes to sport performance, especially when it comes to serious sport performance. In my experience, parents that do really well in terms of supporting their kids understand how to ask great questions, and they empower their kids, right? As opposed to coming in with their own agenda. So asking questions such as, "Hey, like, you know, after a game where you struggled, like, do you want me to give you feedback? When do you want me to give you that feedback? Is there anything else I can do to help support you and build you up? Is there something that you would like me to cut out that you don't find helpful?" Parents that are sort of on the opposite side of that spectrum oftentimes come in and will try to coach their kids up. You know, that's probably the biggest issue that I see. You know, you're trying to coach your kid up and you give immediate feedback when the kid's not ready and they don't want to hear it. And the more you do it, the less likely the kid is to actually utilize your feedback, right? And they just kind of try to push against it, and it just it destroys relationships, it destroys confidence, and you know, that's the biggest issue that I've seen. But you know, and certainly it's refreshing when parents are willing to change their perspective on and start asking good questions.
Yeah, do you feel that those type of questions or non-questions, I should say, those type of interactions post-game, do you feel like that is also very important for coaches and athletes as well, as far as, hey, do you want feedback from me? Do you not want feedback from me? You know, when do you want it, et cetera?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's how you empower athletes. It doesn't matter the age. That's how you empower them. That's how you get them thinking for themselves, right? And ultimately, I think a lot of the time coaches are afraid to ask those types of questions, because I think some coaches' biggest fear is that they're not going to be needed as much. You know, coaches want to feel needed, right? And nonetheless, I mean, like, really, like, when you look at it, the greatest coaches in the world are typically the ones that are willing to produce self-sufficient athletes, to where the coach's role becomes less significant because the athletes learn to make decisions for themselves.
Definitely, where everything isn't necessarily scripted or you have to control every little thing, but and not micromanaging, but you're able to, you know, one of the greatest examples I could give was when I was overseas and playing, you know, his goal, one of my coach's goals was just to be like, you know, at the end of the day when we're playing, I just want to be able to sit down, read the newspaper, drink my coffee, and you guys play, you know, and I don't have to do anything. If I can do that, then I know that I'm a successful coach, you know, and I, you know, kind of being able to go down that line. It's true, because the other thing is, you know, when you get into practices, you know, that's where a lot of the teaching happens. And as they kind of understand the structure and flow and how things are, the players are able to understand those things a little bit more. They need to be able to see those decisions, and they need to be able to do things without you getting, you know, too involved. Right. You know, that's what's going to lead them to be, you know, more and more successful. So, all right. So we spoke a little bit about, you know, parents and what they can do to be more, you know, supportive, so to speak. Let's say you have an athlete who has that overbearing parent, that you can tell, like, this is one of the reasons why they might not be performing. What, you know, how can they go about, you know, approaching their parents or, you know, approaching someone else? What steps can they take to be proactive, to help, you know, kind of change the environment a little bit and change the interactions to allow them to perform better?
Excellent question. You know, it's certainly challenging for a lot of kids, right? Because they're not used to talking to their parents in that way. And, right. They might be afraid of the repercussions and whatnot, but oftentimes I think it really starts with helping the young athletes with expressing gratitude, you know, gratitude for the fact that their parents care so much and they drive them to all these games and whatnot, right? So, like, starting with that, and then from there, like, sharing with the parent, hey, mom, hey, dad, like, you know, I was wondering if I could tell you a little bit more about, like, how I feel when you do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, I was wondering if you could maybe do things differently in these ways, you know. But it's really a matter of framing it in a way that the parent still feels appreciated and that both parties feel like it's a partnership of sorts, you know. Because it doesn't matter how old the kid is, you know. I think having some form of partnership as opposed to that stereotypical, like, parent-child relationship is important, you know, because the kid is an expert in their own right, and you know, so they need to learn how to voice their thoughts, and the parent obviously needs to learn to be receptive to it and establish a partnership.
Yeah, right. And something else I want to speak to that's going to kind of meld some of these together. We talked about the athlete coach relationship, the athlete parent relationship, but to be honest, like, it's that triad and more. You got your peers, you got all these people that go into the support group to create this, you know, championship culture, this environment, you know, whether it's championship or not, you have all these factors that play into it. you know, one of the things that I've seen also that has been very important is that that dynamic between the parent, coach, and athlete. A lot of times I see, especially at those younger levels, if parents aren't buying into what the coaches are doing, a lot of times that type of conversation then comes out in front of the child, which then changes their perspective. And then all of a sudden they start to, you know, they start to lose their sense of belief in the coach as well. And their interactions are strained as a result. So do you find that is an issue? And if that is an issue, you know, how can that be mended by, you know, for example, the coach that sees those type of things happen?
Well, I think coaches probably need to establish firm ground rules for parents right from the start, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean that every parent is going to respect that, but having clear channels of communication, I think, is important. Now, parents obviously want to feel as though they can talk to the coach about their kid, but there's a time and place to do that. And that ideally should be behind closed doors when the kid is not there. Or if you do bring the kid in, then it needs to be a more positive three-way communication, I would say. But it's definitely a problem. I mean, too many parents are trying to coach up their kids and gets in the way of the coach's job. And I think especially in the U.S. it's a giant problem, as you know.
Right. Yeah. And you even see things, especially like on the AAU circuit, especially, and it's funny because you'll see it at 8, 9, 10 years old, coaches that run practices to do things in a certain way. And if you're hearing one line of communication from the coach, do this, then all of a sudden you get another line of communication from the parent, do this. I mean, that creates some type, you know, an internal dichotomy, so to speak, like how, do you see that as an issue as well with some of the younger kids? If you get into that, I don't know how much you get into that.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely seen it. To where the kid feels pulled in different directions. You see it all the way up to the pro level, quite honestly. I mean, you see it even with NBA players that have, family members in their ear, agents, friends, you know, like everybody. And the more voices the athlete hears, no matter what their age is, like it becomes confusing, right? And you get lost in all that. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, it's my job to help the athletes think through it all and learn to make decisions for themselves.
Right. All right. So coming to, getting towards the end here, some of the things that I wanted to make sure I spoke to, one of the things were just, and to hear if you had any advice for athletes and how they interact with social media. Obviously, it's a big driver of anxiety and so on and so forth. And I know you don't get into necessarily the clinical setting of things. If there's a very very troubled individual that has those issues, but what advice can you give to kids that are interacting so much with social media these days, where it kind of puts them off and gets them out of the right mind frame.
Right. It's, I tend to not look at social media strictly as a problem because I think it's just part of our mm-hmm. culture today. It's, right. It can be used as an asset, but it's really a matter of getting these young athletes to think about, hey, like, what does this actually do for me when I get on Instagram, get on Twitter? Like, what do I gain from it, and how does it get in the way of my well-being? You know what I mean? So just generating that awareness and also thinking, like, really paying attention to, like, how much time do I spend on there? How much am I in control of how I utilize social media versus how much is social media controlling me? Because, right. I mean, you know how it is, like, your phone beeps, mm-hmm. like, you automatically will reach for it and, like, check and, sometimes it's just to like look at one message and then before you know it, like looking at one text message leads to, looking at like one Instagram post and then it leads to like scrolling on social media for like the next half hour. And, Right. Know, like you just kind of wonder where your date
snowball of events.
Yeah.
Okay. Another thing I want to speak to a little bit is just, you know, confidence. We talked about all these different tools, but in general, an athlete wants to get more confident. I know there's a lot of things that depend, but are there any kind of general frameworks where you can give, like, hey, if you want to be in it, you know, and there's personality differences and so on and so forth, but is there anything athletes that you can do specifically from your understanding of sports performance that they can do to, you know, improve their confidence?
Well, my first question typically is, do you feel like you've earned the right to be confident? Because yep. if you're not getting it in the weight room, you're not getting the reps in on the court. I mean, you know, you got to have something to be confident about, you know?
Yes. Yes.
So, I mean, that's really where it starts. Now beyond that, it's, you know, certainly all the things that we've already talked about, like visuals, like seeing yourself visually, coming through under pressure, things of that nature, like figuring out how to stay present minded and focused through tools like meditation, engaging positively with your teammates, all those different things can essentially like feed into your sense of confidence. I think the anxiety piece that we talked about earlier is big as well. So really helping athletes understand what anxiety is and what it isn't, and then also just keeping it in perspective, because like you're feeling like you've lost your confidence and you're a little bit shaky out there, it's not the end of the world. Like it's a simple mechanism that all of us experience at one point or another. And if we keep it in balance and we address it proactively, we can learn to be confident even when we don't always feel our most comfortable.
Right. Right. And I just wanted to highlight the fact that I'm glad you said it in the beginning. I was hoping you were going to. Are you getting your reps in? Are you in the weight room? Are you doing these things that allow you to be confident? You know, there's plenty of research showing that the best way to be confident is to have successful repetition, like time and time and time again. And it's not just, you know, that easy, successful repetition of, hey, I made 100 shots. But it's like, hey, you have to make them game-like, pressure-like repetitions, especially as you get to higher and higher levels, because that's where it starts to translate. And I think that's where a lot of, you know, I've had parents and kids come to me, well, I want them to be more confident. Well they have to become better. Right. They have to become more skilled. They have to do those type of things if they want to earn that right to be a little bit more confident out on the court. One other thing that I wanted to touch on is just a little bit on perfectionism and burnout. You know, those two sometimes go hand in hand where, you know, people want to be so good and they put in all this time and especially when they're younger, over time that can lead to burnout, where kids are just, you know, they're done with the sport. They no longer have the motivation. And obviously it's a multifactorial thing where, you know, kids can be worn down, they're not recovering, they're just playing too much. But what can kids do and what can parents do to help reinforce, positive growth and development while minimizing the risk of burning out in the long term?
All right. So, I mean, that type of growth mindset is very process-focused, right? That doesn't mean you don't have outcome goals to strive towards, but it's really about being deliberate about your process each and every day. And part of that process is being willing to make mistakes and understanding that those mistakes actually facilitate learning at the end of the day. So setting up challenging learning environments that, you know, to where the athlete automatically is going to make mistakes, I think that's where it's really at. And so helping athletes understand that what they perceive as failure really is an integral part of the learning process. So that's, I think that's what's really most foundational in that sense.
Yeah. And then I think at the same time, that also is a good way to facilitate, those, that internal motivation that can help you, you know, create, you know, those goals it's kind of a chicken or egg thing, right? Where you want to be motivated, but at the same time, you have to be able to set goals to get there. And they kind of play hand in hand. So what type of, you know, and we'll finish up here in a minute, but what, what type of things can athletes do to set, you know, realistic goals, to set, you know, SMART goals, et cetera? What are the processes that they can do where it's, they just, hey, I want to be able to do this. I want to be able to set it by this time. Can you just take it through the process of, you know, how to set goals effectively?
Yeah, I mean, you spoke to SMART goal setting. I mean, there's a lot to it, obviously, you know, being specific with your goals and you know, making them measurable and setting time frames and whatnot. A lot of it too is really about, you know, your environment and who are the people you look to build confidence, but then also to stay engaged with the learning process and feel challenged at an optimal level as much as possible. So if I as a young athlete spend all day, you know, trying to do a move that like Steph Curry just did on TV last night, it might be fun for a while, but it could also potentially become demotivating because I'm not close to that skill level yet. But if I look at a player that's maybe a couple of years more advanced than me, now I have something more tangible to strive towards before I eventually try to be more like Steph Curry, you know? So really figuring out what that optimal challenge point is to where you have a chance at success, but it doesn't come easy.
Right. Right. And final question, as a parent, you know, there's a lot of ways to build, not a lot of ways away, but there's external motivation and internal motivation. And a lot of times those that are a little bit more internally motivated are able to kind of get to those higher levels. What as a parent would they be able to do, parents be able to do to help facilitate or foster that internal motivation to allow kids to get to those levels?
Yeah, you know, typically I don't even necessarily distinguish between internal and external motivation. I mean, to me, it's really it's really a matter of understanding what is motivating to the individual. And that's where we've done a lot of work with the personality assessments and things like that. But really understanding, hey, like, does, you know, is this kid wired in a way that he finds structure motivating, or does he find it more motivating when he gets to be a little bit more creative and free flowing with this approach to practice? Does he find it more motivating when he gets to work by him or herself, or is it more fun doing stuff in a team environment? So understanding your kid's personality at a fundamental level, and obviously it's depending on how old the kid is, it could still change over time. But essentially what I'm saying is figure out ways to set up the environment in such a way that it matches up with the individual's personality and what's motivating to them.
Gotcha. Awesome. Well, yeah, I know we're a little bit past time and we were working with some technical difficulties here, but we're right around an hour and 5 minutes or so. So we're going to let you get going here. But you know, before we do that, what's the name of the company again? Where can they find you online? You know, what social media platforms do you have, et cetera?
Yeah. So it's Cortex Performance, and Cortex being spelled Cortex. And I can be found on Instagram at Cortex Performance, on Twitter as well. We have a Facebook business page. With that being said, I am terrible at keeping up with my social media. I'm not a big social media guy. There is some content on there and ways to get in touch as well. So.
Awesome. All right, Reiner. Well, thank you very much for your time, and I hope I never slaughter your name again. Reiner Meisterjahn.
You did it, man. You did it. All right. Appreciate you, Eric. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
Take care, you too. Bye.